Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was America's most significant economic event after World War II? You might name the tech bubble, the recession of the early 80s, even the fallout after 9/11. Well, my guest today would argue that the rise and fall of double-digit inflation in the 1960s and 70s has been the dominant factor in the course of the U.S. economy ever since, not simply as a rational launch point for major decisions, but as an event that made an indelible impression on our financial culture. So if that is true, what can the great inflation tell us about what's to come? Robert J. Samuelson is a columnist for Newsweek and for The Washington Post. His new book is called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past, Present, and Future of American Affluence. Bob, welcome to Think.
Nice to be with you, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
So what makes this rapid rise of inflation? We started with almost no inflation in 1960, and we went on through the 70s, and it just went higher and higher. What makes that all so pivotal in our economic history?
Well, I'd break it up into two parts. One is the rise. As you say, it was virtually nothing in 1960, and by 1979, it was 13%, and people didn't know whether it was going to go much higher, 15 or 20%. Successive governments had been unsuccessful in controlling it, and it appeared that it just couldn't be controlled. The consequences of that, if you look back and at the consequences of that, one was political, the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. Inflation and its apparent uncontrollability, if you use a word that probably doesn't exist, was the central issue in that campaign. And people were very upset by inflation. Pollsters who studied the issue concluded that inflation was the issue that upset and bothered Americans and frightened Americans more than any other issue since the Great Depression, more than Watergate, more than the war in Vietnam. And that the reason, I think, for that is that it affected everybody, and nobody could see when it would stop. So Ronald Reagan's election was one, and I'd say the most obvious consequence of the high inflation. If inflation had been 3% in 1979, I think Jimmy Carter would actually have been reelected. A second consequence is that high inflation just destabilized the economy in other ways. We had four recessions between 1969 and 1981 of growing severity. And up until that last recession, they just inflicted pain without any gain. We had higher unemployment, but we didn't get any respite in lower inflation. So that was a second consequence. The third consequence of higher inflation in that period was that it just killed the stock market. It amazingly, in 1982, the stock market was exactly the same place it had been in 1965. And given the huge increase in prices over that period, its real value was actually much less. So those were among the consequences of inflation going up. And if you like, we can talk about the decline of inflation and why that had such a profound effect.
Well, we'll talk about it in a minute. I just want to stop for a moment, though, and get back to why this happened in the first place. Because, you know, in the late 50s, the inflation that you'd seen after the Korean War and after World War II had abated. And the Keynesians were talking not only about inflation not being a problem, but about their ability to manage the economy to the extent that unemployment would no longer exist.
Well, that was the problem. We had a very prosperous economy in the 1950s. People after World War II feared a return to the Great Depression when unemployment in the 1930s averaged 18%. By contrast, in the 1950s, unemployment averaged 4.5%. But we had three recessions during the 50s and the early 60s, and academic economists felt that they had learned enough about the economy that they could actually manage the business cycle, that they could keep the economy expanding with few, if any, recessions, and they could keep unemployment very low, what was then called full employment of 4%. And these ideas were accepted first by President Kennedy and then by President Johnson. And in trying to implement them, what happened was they were wrong. They couldn't do this. And as they tried to use budget deficits and easy money to stimulate the economy and keep unemployment close to 4%, what they did is they just created higher inflation. They created too much money chasing too few goods, excessive demand chasing too little supply, and prices went up. And so the Federal Reserve every once in a while would put the economy into a recession trying to get prices to come down, and they would temporarily, but the recessions never lasted very long. And once the recovery started, just prices kept going back up again.
Bob, sorry to interrupt you. What had they left out of their calculations?
Well, what they left out of their calculations was that once the government made this promise, the self-restraint that businesses and workers had felt in setting wages and prices were out the window. Businesses said, well, we can raise our prices because demand is always for our goods are always going to be high because the government has told us that. And workers would say, well, we can raise our wages because we don't have to fear unemployment. If, our company goes bankrupt for some reason, we can always go out and get another job because the government is going to create permanently full employment. And so then you got into the psychology of a wage-price spiral. As prices went up, workers expected their wages to keep up with prices and a bit more. And as wages and other compensation costs went up, companies had to raise their prices. And it was just a dog chasing its own tail. And that's fundamentally what happened. There are a lot of technical explanations for it, but if you want to boil it down to what actually happened, that's what happened.
Robert J. Samuelson is my guest. His new book is called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past, Present, and Future of American Affluence. You give a lot of credit, Bob, to then-Fed chairman under Ronald Reagan, Paul Volcker, for finding a way out of that inflation in the early 80s. What was his strategy?
Well, in my book, there are really two heroes, I suppose. One is Paul Volcker, who was chairman of the Federal Reserve between 1979 and 1987, and the other is Ronald Reagan. And Volcker didn't have a very sophisticated strategy. And they were united in what I call a compact of conviction. They were never close personally, but they did have a political alliance that was mostly unspoken. And they both believed that high and rising inflation was poisonous for American society and the American economy, and it had to be brought under control. And Volcker's strategy to do this was not very sophisticated. He simply raised interest rates, squeezed credit, lowered growth of the money supply, and put the economy into its worst recession since World War II, the theory being that as you create more unemployment, as you create gluts of cars, of clothes, of consumer goods of every kind, of services, as there's excess office space and empty stores and shopping centers, that prices will come down. The laws of supply and demand take over. And if you do it long enough, inflation will subside to very low levels, and people might actually believe that the government won't allow this to happen again, and that the self-restraint that had existed prior to the 1960s will come into being again. And that's exactly what he did. But the social costs of this, the temporary social costs, were horrific. As I said, unemployment went to almost 11% in late 1982, and even when Reagan was running for re-election in 1984, it was 7.5% on average. So there were staggering social costs of this, and Reagan's role was very simple. He supported Volcker. There was a huge amount of criticism, really rabid criticism, of the Federal Reserve and Volcker as unemployment rose from both Democrats and Republicans. And I am convinced that if anybody else besides Reagan had been president, they would not have allowed Volcker to do this. They would have criticized Volcker and forced the Federal Reserve to relent, and then we would have simply gone through the same process again. We would have had a recession. It would have been harsh, but not as harsh as it was. And once we came into a recovery, inflation would have speeded up once again.
Well, you have to wonder, even with Reagan, if all this had reached its nadir in maybe the beginning of his second term, and he would have held some of the blame for what had happened ahead of time, whether he'd be able to do this. In other words, he was able to come in and say, I'm different from Jimmy Carter. I'm going to, put someone in place that's going to do this in a very different way. He had the sort of political capital to be able to do that because he was a brand new president.
Well, I don't really believe it was that simple. Or maybe it was even simpler. I think that when people voted in 1980 between Reagan and Carter, they had a fairly stark choice. People decided, I think, that many Americans decided that Carter, as smart a man as he was, as well-intentioned as he was incompetent and simply did not know how to be president, with inflation and the erratic performance of the economy being exhibit number one. On the other hand, Reagan had a reputation of being a grade B movie actor. A lot of people had a hard time imagining this guy as president. Aside from that, he was seen as an outsider to Washington and as a potential radical. In other words, somebody who would really disrupt things rather dramatically. And he was also seen as being dangerous, that, you know, his foreign policy might be dangerous. But I think that during the campaign, he reassured people that he was not going to blow up the world. And once he did that, people made a very simple choice. Did they want the known incompetent or the potential radical? They knew that Carter couldn't control inflation. They didn't know whether Reagan could or they didn't know whether Reagan could or couldn't, but they were willing to take a gamble that he could. And I think that Reagan did this simply because he believed he had no choice. And there are times when politicians need to be flexible, when they need to show the capacity for compromise, but there are times when politicians need to have their convictions and stick by them because they think they're right. And if they are right, they ultimately reap the political rewards for being right and being right in the face of being unpopular. Now, Reagan's popularity ratings plunged. I think they got as low as 36% in early 1983 when unemployment was so high. But he stuck by his guns, and by 1984, people had a sense that the economy was no longer veering out of control.
And in fact, you think that his protection of Volcker and his giving Volcker the room he needed to do what he needed to do was a greater economic achievement than any of the tax cuts that came under the Reagan administration or any of the spending cuts?
I think that this was his greatest domestic achievement, bar none. And he did not cut spending very much. He did reduce top tax rates, and I think that probably had a favorable effect on the economy. And he helped simplify the tax system slightly, and I don't want to demean that. But if you take the hypothetical, what would have happened during the Reagan years if he had done everything he did do, but he had not controlled inflation? I think it's quite conceivable he would have lost the 1984 election, and certainly on leaving office, if inflation had been 10, 12, 15%, 20%, I don't think he would have been judged a successful president.
So what were the benefits that came out of falling inflation?
Well, we're in a sort of paradoxical situation today. The financial crisis that we're going through and the economic crisis that we're going through, I think, actually have their origins in this disinflation and the fact that inflation came down from very high levels to very low levels. But for most of the period since the early 80s, actually that process benefited the economy. The first and most obvious thing it did, when prices stayed down and inflation did not soar up frequently and rapidly, the Federal Reserve was not forced to take these periodic, embark on these periodic policies of putting the economy into a recession. And so we really only had two short recessions between 1982 and up until the present. We had a recession of 1990-91 and a recession of 2001. But each of those only lasted 8 months, and they're relatively mild by historic standards. The second thing that happened is that stock prices went through the ceiling. As I said earlier, in 1982, the stock market was roughly where it was in 1965. But as interest rates came down, people started taking their money out of money market funds and treasury securities and putting it into the stock market, and by the end of the 1990s, the stock market was over 10,000. That had gone up tenfold since 1982. And the same thing happened with housing prices on a lesser degree. As mortgage rates came down, people were able to afford to pay more for their homes, and real estate prices went up. So Americans, on paper, got richer. They spent more of their incomes. They borrowed more, and everybody enjoyed the prosperity.
We're talking to Robert J. Samuelson. His new book is The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath. We'll be back after a break. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Newsweek and Washington Post columnist Robert J. Samuelson. His newest book is called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past, Present, and Future of American Affluence. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Bob, once things were going well, and you mentioned the prosperity that we were seeing in the low inflation at the end of the 90s, people started getting lax in their habits, not just people, but also businesses. Too much credit was given out too cheaply. We racked up debt we weren't good for, and everybody moved their money from boring old bonds to the excitement of the stock market.
You used a term earlier that I wish I had used in my book, financial culture. And I think that that's really what happened, is that people became seduced by the constant prosperity. They became conditioned by the fact that these markets went up from year to year, and they went up by large amounts. Everybody knew that it would be fluctuations, but the upward trend seemed to be relentless and irreversible. And so people lost their sense of risk. And if you take the prime, subprime mortgage debacle as a good example of how we got in our present problems, everybody now knows that there were loans made that shouldn't have been made, that the mortgage bankers who first made these loans did not insist on proper documentation of income and assets, that probably some of the borrowers fibbed, that there was a fair amount of speculation going on, that the investment bankers put this stuff in very complicated securities that they then sold and were overrated by the rating agencies, and on and on and on. But all these practices occurred in a climate in which people thought the risk of making a mistake had really declined or even disappeared. And so what if you made a loan and it couldn't be paid off? You would take the underlying house, the loan would go into foreclosure, you would take the underlying house, and because housing prices had gone up 10 or 15 or 20% since you had made the loan, you would simply sell the house and recoup the money you would lend. So there really was no risk in doing this. Well, we discovered that if you were creating a bubble as we were, that these very self-serving assumptions turned out to be not true. That once the bubble burst, prices would go down, as they have come down rather dramatically. And now all this is feeding on each other. And that the process of declining housing and stock prices make people feel poor, they spend less, and the economy gets worse and things go down again.
A decade ago, November 24th, 1998, the Dow closed at 93.12. As of about 5 minutes ago, we were at 82.89, 1,000 points between those two things. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that if you had had an index fund based on the Dow, you wouldn't have made any money for the last decade or not. I think, you know, markets swing wildly in both directions. And a good question today is whether this market is oversold as the market at its peak was overbought. And we just don't know the answer to that. There are really two explanations. Either the market is oversold, in which case if you buy stocks today and you're very brave and you buy stocks, you will make ultimately a good return.
Oversold meaning undervalued, essentially.
Right. The other possibility is that what's going on in the real economy of production and jobs is going to get much, much worse. And the stock market is simply giving us an advance warning of this. And it's one or the other. And I don't know which it is. And I guess that's what makes my doing what I do as interesting as it is. You're never certain where things are going.
Well, you know, Bob, what's both interesting and terrifying, and I would imagine economists share this concern, is that sometimes it doesn't matter what the reality is. It's again, that financial culture. It's people's perception of what's about to happen that has a greater impact even than what's really taking place.
I think that psychology is enormously important. And what we know now is that that moods feed on each other. And in the euphoria that existed in the late 90s, we got a stock market that was wildly overvalued because everybody thought that if they didn't buy, they were missing out on this great bonanza. And even those, some of the people who felt that prices were unrealistic, felt that it could get out before they crashed. The same thing happened in the housing market. As housing prices were going up, there was sort of a buyer's panic. People bought houses because they feared if the house was $175,000 today and they could barely afford it or perhaps couldn't afford it, that they should buy it anyway, because tomorrow, 6 months from tomorrow, 8 months, a year from tomorrow, instead of being $175,000, it would be $200,000, and they really couldn't afford it. So you get these mood swings that really do affect the underlying economy. And one of the reasons I think we've been so inept at predicting these things is that economists, professional economists, are very suspicious of psychology and very suspicious of confidence or lack of confidence and how popular moods can affect either the real economy or the financial markets. And so they really don't incorporate those kind of things into their models.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Robert J. Samuelson. The new book is called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath. Let's speak to Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Hi. One thing this past election did was to shine a big fat spotlight on our leaders and how well they truly understood how our American financial culture operates. And for example, I became convinced that Sarah Palin didn't understand the process well enough to come anywhere close to changing it. I mean, I was wondering whether you came to your own conclusions as to how well past presidents actually comprehend the process or comprehended the process or the manipulation of the process. Thank you very much.
Well, that's an interesting question, and I don't think that in general most politicians are very well grounded in economics or finance. Most of them have not had any kind of business experience. They're usually, I'm trying to think of any, I mean, Bush had a little bit of business experience. It doesn't seem to have served him very well. But Clinton was a lawyer, professional politician. George Herbert Walker Bush had a little bit of business experience, not very much, but essentially he was a professional government official and politician. Reagan really didn't have any business experience. So their judgment really comes into play on who they pick as their advisors and what their basic views of how the system works are. Reagan had a view that the free market system was very important, that ultimately the source of economic growth was people taking risks, people creating new things, people investing in expansion, in new products, and that you had the government had to create a climate in which that would occur, and that you had to have the right kind of incentives. And he chose advisors who were sympathetic with that point of view. We'll have to see where Obama, I think Obama has I just watched his press conference about an hour ago, and he seems to have a very intuitive understanding of the economy. And he's picked, very experienced advisors. But I'm not certain he has the kind of convictions that Reagan had. I think his convictions more lie along the lines, well, there's a machine here, and I picked it sort of the mechanics to sort of fix it. And once we get it fixed, we need to spend more time deciding who should get pieces of this economic pie. The machine is turning out, it's creating the economic pie, and we need to be a little bit more concerned on how it's distributed. So what the presidents bring to the office are a set of values and a set of core principles, but they usually don't bring any fundamental understanding or technical understanding of how the economy operates. But that's true in many areas that they operate in, and their judgment in picking their advisors is really what counts.
There was a little flurry of rumors before Tim Geithner was named Treasury Secretary that Barack Obama was interested in Paul Volcker for the job. Did you take those rumors seriously?
Well, I interviewed Volcker several times for the book, and I've been in contact with him once or twice since my interviews. And although he's in his early 80s, he certainly seems to be mentally sharp, probably as sharp as he ever was, and he seems to be physically fit and vigorous. So Could he have done the job? I think he probably could have. My sense when those rumors were floating around was that if he took the job, or if it was offered to him, he would have a very vigorous deputy, say somebody like Geithner, who would sort of be in line to succeed him after a year or so. I don't know whether he wanted it, and I didn't ask him, and he didn't volunteer it, so I don't know whether he wanted it. I think he's certainly very engaged in public issues today, but he's been there, he's done that, and I'm not sure that if it was if the president offered to him and pleaded with him to do it, I'm sure he would have done it. He's been a public servant all his life, but I don't think it was something he pined after.
Robert J. Samuelson is my guest. His new book is called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past, Present, and Future of American Affluence. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Scott in Plano. Hi, Scott.
Oh, hello. Yes, a question for Mr. Samuelson. I'm curious what your take is on why in the mainstream media we don't hear more of the main issues being debt leverage and transparency and in the corporate and government level. And also, all the solutions seem to be bailouts and stimulus when we're approaching the fact that more credit or more debt essentially acts to contract GDP instead of increase it as it did in prior times. Thank you so much. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks.
Right, I'm sorry. The first part of the question was about transparency. What was the question again exactly?
You know what? We don't have him on the line anymore. And
well, let me just
I'm not sure
speak
I can rephrase
generally
it perfectly.
About the situation. Nobody likes these bailouts, by the way. I mean, I haven't found anybody that likes them. Republicans don't like them. Democrats don't like them. It looks bad, bailing out all these Wall Street firms. But not only does it look bad, it raises a lot of very messy issues to which there are no obvious and easy answers. You know, how much money do you give a particular institution? Why this institution and not that institution? Some of it's very ad hoc. The rescue of Citigroup that occurred today, clearly they're so large that they had to be protected from failure, because if they had failed, there would have been a massive crisis of confidence in financial markets. But all this is very messy. People don't like it. But the reason for doing it is that there isn't a system out here, an interconnected financial system, and it is essential for the economy. It provides the lubricant for any modern economy, credit, loans, bonds, investment of one sort. And if the system doesn't provide that lubricant, the engine doesn't work as well. And if there's really none at all, then it stops working altogether. So that's the reason you have to do this. And the hope is that most of this money will be repaid, and that some of it, or even much of it, will be repaid with a profit to the government. So it may, if things work out well, we don't know whether they will, but if things work out well, then the government may have no net expenditure on these things. Now, the other part of the question was, why are we emphasizing credit so much when in the past credit has led to economic contractions? Well, like many things in economics, credit is a double-edged sword. It's essential to have credit for a normally functioning economy. I mean, businesses need to borrow to buy supplies, to make products, to sell, and then they repay the loans when they sell it. But you've got to sort of, farmers have got to borrow to get seed and fertilizer and finance their plantings. Companies have to borrow to buy products from manufacturers, which then they're going to sell in retail stores, and then they repay. So even people who are not borrowing for longer terms, like a car loan or a mortgage, borrowing is needed just for the normal functioning of an economy. But the caller is right in the sense that if borrowing is overdone, if too many bad loans are made, you get bankruptcies, you get foreclosures, you get loans that aren't that go into default. And if there are too many of those, the economy goes into recession. And so the secret here is to somehow extend enough credit, but not too much. But it's not a secret that anybody has solved in the history of economics. And that's why we have not gotten, one of the reasons we've not been able to abolish business cycles.
Assuming, Bob, that we are looking at some kind of extended recession and we don't know how deep it's going to go, do you think it's likely that we'll see some productivity gains in the economy? In other words, businesses have to become more efficient and therefore they can produce more with fewer resources because they're required to?
Well, I think if we come out of this, when we come out of this, we may see an uptick in productivity, precisely the process that you talk about. And we have, productivity has been pretty good, again, for precisely the reasons that you talk about. When companies are stressed, they tend to try to become more efficient so they can squeeze more profit out of their shrunken business. Unfortunately, one of the ways they do that is they fire people. So the company had 1,500 people on Thursday. The next Thursday, they only have 1,200. And if they're producing the same amount, their productivity goes up. So, it's a double-edged sword. I am of the school that you have to go through these things periodically, not only because we haven't learned how to eliminate them, but because they do have some good effects. They have the effects of putting the most inefficient, the weakest companies out of business and rewarding the strongest companies. But it's a harsh process, and we need to sort of reconcile ourselves to the fact that the capitalism, which is generally a great system, has a lot of glaring weaknesses. And we've been trying for the last 60 years to find some mix of raw capitalism and government compassion that satisfies most people most of the time without crippling capitalism or imposing undue hardship on the general public. And it's always a work in progress.
Robert J. Samuelson is with us. He's a columnist for Newsweek and The Washington Post. His new book is called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past, Present, and Future of American Affluence. Join us via email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Robert J. Samuelson is here. His new book is called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past, Present, and Future of American Affluence. Bob, I guess the title of your book really requires us to step back and define American affluence, particularly given the fact that you think that we might very well be dissatisfied with the recovery when it inevitably comes, at whatever time that happens.
Well, I think part of American affluence is very obvious. It's that having a roof over your head, a stable job, being able to afford essentials. But beyond that, I think what Americans think of when they think of affluence is sort of the constant process of getting ahead, of having higher incomes, higher living standards, perhaps not dramatic in any one year, but over a period of 3, 4, 5 years of feeling that you're further ahead than you were a few years ago, and in a few years you're going to be further ahead than you are now. And I do fear that when we come out of this recession, that we will have slower economic growth, and there will be so many demands on it that many people won't feel that they are getting ahead, that whatever income gains we have will be siphoned off either to higher taxes or higher energy prices or higher health care costs. And all those things confer benefits on us. They don't contribute to the discretionary income that Americans would like to think defines their living standard. So I do think that we may be facing a period of slower growth and more social conflict as to who ought to get what pieces of the economic pie.
have to wonder about business affluence as well. You know, it never seems to make any sense to have cash reserves on hand when money is plentiful and it's cheap to borrow. But now I wonder if there will be a memory by these businesses in a renewed economy that they might need to try and keep larger supplies of liquid assets available in the event that something like this happens again, that the credit market really shrinks up.
Well, interestingly, the shortage of liquidity of cash, as you put it, or cash, is felt less by mainstream businesses. There are obviously some exceptions, the auto companies being the most conspicuous, than by financial institutions. Because the mainstream businesses, after the dot-com fiasco of the late 90s, got in the situation that you described. A lot of them were short of cash and short of liquidity. And that made an impression, as you suggested, on the people who run these companies. And so businesses are actually in better financial shape than many households and many of our financial institutions. The financial institutions borrowed very heavily, and in some cases they made bad decisions with their borrowed money, and that has really undermined the entire system. But a lot of the sort of, you know, basic businesses of the country are in reasonably good shape considering, and they are because this earlier episode of being short of cash really did make an impression on.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to David in Richardson. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Just before the break, Mr. Robert made the comment, which I agree with, that these kind of corrections occur naturally, occasionally, which helps the bad companies go under, those who make bad decisions. But yet here we are bailing out companies who have made some pretty egregious bad decisions. And I'll pick on GM. My wife drives a Honda. I drive a Ford. I don't like their products. It just doesn't work. But yet, as a taxpayer, I'm about to own some GM. And I understand they're too big to fail, but, you know, are they too big to fail? And won't the cycle just repeat if GM continues to make products that people just don't want? And on a side point, if they bring back the EV1, their electric car that they built, rename it the EV2, I think it'd probably be a pretty good seller right about now.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Well, you know, there's a time for principle and there's a time for pragmatism. If our economy had 4% unemployment or even 5% unemployment and GM was where it is today, I would say, well, tough. Let them deal with it. If they can't get their unions to come to agreement on lower costs, if they can't get their creditors to write down some of their debts, if they can't write new contracts with their dealers, let them go bankrupt. Let them try to reorganize. That's what the system is about. So I agree with the caller up to that point. But we are not in that kind of economy today. The economy is weakening very rapidly. Unemployment is already 6.5%. There are a lot of economists who think it will go well over 8, some over 9%. Do we really want to take the chance that we're going to make that much, much worse by letting one of the big three go bankrupt and basically cease operations? It's a big gamble, and I don't think we should take it now. Now, I don't own a GM car. We have three cars. We have a Mercury, which is essentially a Ford, and an older Ford, 1996 Ford, and a Honda. And I think the Mercury, which we bought a couple of years ago, is a first-rate car, and the Honda is a terrific car. The older Ford was less terrific. But most of the comparisons I've seen of American and foreign nameplate cars, mainly Japanese, show that there are not wide gaps between the quality of the American cars and the Japanese cars. Certainly the gap has been dramatically narrowed since the early 1980s. It's true that the products that the big three are now capable of making, with a heavy emphasis on trucks and SUVs, is not what the market is demanding. But the market has shifted radically because of the run-up in oil prices. And I think if you can hold one thing against the auto executives is that over 20 or 25 years, they've never come in and proposed a public policy that would create a market for a consistent mix of cars. They've let themselves be whipsawed by these run-up and rises and decline in oil prices, and they get slaughtered when the market goes against them. And that, if they are bailed out, we need to correct that and create a market in which people are demanding to buy the kind of cars that the government is ordering the manufacturers to make, namely fuel-efficient cars.
Well, another gap that's narrowed, Bob, if I understand correctly, is that of the number of foreign cars that are produced by foreign companies that are actually made in the United States. Honda and Toyota in particular produce a lot of these.
Yeah, there are a huge number of transplants now in the United States which are producing or assembling cars here. They often have parts from abroad, but they have more parts from the United States. And it's true that the labor costs in those plants are lower than the big threes. And for the big three to be viable, they've got to get their labor costs way down. And I think they should get them below their competitors. But that's part of any kind of a rescue. If we rescue them, we should not just give them money. There must be a major restructuring of these companies so that they're competitive in the long run.
Let's go next to Mike in Arlington. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I have a quick question. I just wanted to know, in the history of the United States, has there been a time where giving tax cuts to 5% of our population, the rich in this case, has actually worked in jump-starting our economy in the past? I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I don't think anybody is suggesting right now that we give additional tax cuts to the top 5%. It's true that Bush in 2001 and then 2003 gave tax cuts to these people, but they weren't the only people who received tax cuts. There were tax cuts all along the spectrum, and there's obviously a huge partisan disagreement as to whether the rich got too much of that pie. Certainly President-elect Obama isn't proposing new tax cuts for the wealthy, and he would like to cut back some of the existing tax breaks they get. So that's really not on the table now. And I would point out everybody's against trickle-down economics, but a lot of economics is trickle-down. I mean, the people who have more money spend more money. And unless you want to take it all away from them and make them poor, either redistribute it or give it to the government. If the well-to-do and the rich stop spending, the economy's going to have trouble. Because, it's like Willie Sutton said of why he robs banks. He said that's where the money is.
We've talked a lot this hour, Bob, about the effect of high inflation and then of disinflation on the other side. We haven't talked about the situation we seem to have, at least very recently, which is deflation. How does that play into what you've looked at in the past half century?
Well, we haven't had deflation yet. We had a month where consumer prices came down about 1%, but if you look at what happened to them over the course of the year, they're still up about 3.5%. So we're not close to having a general deflation yet. And most of that price decline for the month was driven by lower gasoline and fuel prices. So it's somewhat exceptional. Deflation for your listeners means an actual decline in prices, where disinflation means just lower inflation. Instead of having price increases of 7 or 8%, you only have price increases of 2 or 3%. That's disinflation. Deflation means that prices actually go down 1, 2, 5, 10, 15%. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, my recollection is they went down about 25% between 1929 and 1933. And when prices really begin to collapse, as they did in the Great Depression, then you've got a big problem because, first, businesses that have outstanding loans can't repay their loans because they're being paid, that the prices they're receiving are so much less than they had expected to receive. So they begin to default on their loans, and the financial system goes and gets into trouble. Also, when you have a huge amount of deflation, people begin postponing purchases. They think, well, I need a new car, but the car costs $20,000 today. Maybe in 6 months it's only going to cost $18,000, so why shouldn't I wait? well, if too many people do that, production stops and unemployment goes up, and again, the economy gets in bad shape. So that's what you fear about deflation. I think if we had a mild deflation of 1 or 2%, it would probably help, and people wouldn't notice, and their incomes in terms of purchasing power would be greater, and it would probably stimulate the economy. But it's an open issue.
You have written, and it sounds like with some certainty, that this will not get anywhere near as bad as the Great Depression. What tells you that's true?
Well, when I wrote it, I felt much more confident in saying it than I do today. I still feel fairly confident in saying it. Well, you have to remember the Great Depression was pretty awful. Unemployment in 1933 was 25%. It averaged 18% for the 1930s. This was not just an economic downturn. This was an economic catastrophe. Today's unemployment is 6.5%, and if it goes to the worst it's been since World War II, it would go to 11%. That's a huge gap between that and the Great Depression. Government has been much more active, much more quickly in trying to put a safety net under the economy now than in the 1930s. And actually, if you look, economic historians that look back at the Great Depression have concluded that government policies actually made it worse, that the government should not have allowed 40% of the nation's banks to fail as it did. So there are big differences between now and then. Another big difference is that in the 30s, manufacturing and farming were still the dominant parts of the economy, and both of them are subject to wild fluctuations. I mean, if people stop buying big-ticket items like cars, appliances, furniture, machinery, manufacturing really takes a nosedive. The kind of services that are now a huge part of the economy, healthcare, education, recreation, whatever, these services don't experience those really wild fluctuations. If government is much larger in terms of transferring income, that tends also to sustain purchasing power. So there are big differences between now and then, and I think they're sufficiently large to make another Great Depression, not an impossibility, but, you know, talking about 1 in 100, maybe 1 in 500.
In the 20 seconds we have left, is there a particular way that you'd encourage people to adjust their outlook in order to endure what's coming before we see some kind of relief?
Well, I would say that people should not get too pessimistic. I mean, this country's come through an awful lot, and public pessimism isn't going to help. It's not going to help you personally. It's not going to help the country. So I would say don't be too gloomy. My wife would counter by saying, I've never seen a glass half full, but what can I say?
It's never too late to start, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. I'm trying to reform myself.
Robert J. Samuelson is a columnist for Newsweek and for The Washington Post. His new book is called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past, Present, and Future of American Affluence. Bob, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.